You've mentioned Texas a couple of times. When did you first leave for Texas, and why were you going there?
In Texas, there was a strike that was going on, and it started. Gene Nelson, who was a organizing the boycott with Shenley, had gone to Houston, Texas.
And then, that's the author, Eugene Nelson.
Right. He was one of the original organizers with the farm workers at that time. And he'd gone to work
here in California?
In California, yeah. He was from here.
And then he went to Texas
first. He went to Texas on the boycott. And Tony Orendine went to Chicago, and I don't know where other people went, but they're all over the place. And after the success of the Shenley boycott, Caesar had asked everybody to come home. Well, then the DeGeorgia boycott started, and people went back out again. But in the meantime, when Gene was in Houston, he ran into an attorney named Chris Dixie, who later became a lawyer that figured into our struggle in Texas. And Chris was part of a group called the Harris County Democrats. In fact, I think he was the founder of that, which were the Liberal Democrats, the Progressives.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris's father was a Greek immigrant that moved first to Memphis and then to Texas, and just thought that Dixie would be a good name to have since he was in Dixie, and so that's where he got the name. But Chris basically was, I imagine during the 30s or 40s, he was some sort of a socialist, but he was really into worker stuff, and he was the labor lawyer in Houston. And he'd, in the meantime, there was a group, now there were two major currents in the Democratic Party in Texas. One were the people that, you know, came into the party before World War II, and were part of a very conservative section of it, John Conley and people like that. Well, not so much John Conley, but a lot of other people. And then after World War II, the liberals were on the ascendancy in the Democratic Party, and that was represented by Lyndon Johnson and others.
Mm-hmm.
And the election that took place in 1948 between Johnson, who was a congressman running for senator, and Coke Stevenson, who was a governor that was running for senator, was like a breaking point. And it was South Texas, basically, that had cheated on the election, and the liberals had cheated, and LBJ got elected. And but in any event, throughout most of South Texas, there were two factions in the Democratic Party, the old party and the new party. And in Starr County, where this strike took place, that was a reality. Well, by the 1960s, there were people disillusioned with the new party. So, particularly in the Chicano community, they organized a group. Well, it came out of the Kennedy campaign. The Kennedy campaign, like, attracted me, attracted, you know, many thousands of people all over the country who had never been involved in politics. So out of the Kennedy campaign, they started a group called the Political Association of Spanish-Speaking Organizations, called PASO. And they were the younger Chicanos that, you know, represented a more progressive point of view. So you actually had three factions in the Democratic Party. And there was a group in Starr County that was a PASO group, and that was also in the wake of the Teamster victory in Crystal City. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No, I'm not.
But that was a very historic effort to organize a spinach cannery in Crystal City. And I forgot the man's name. Was head of the PASO chapter in Crystal City, and they linked up with Southern Conference of Teamsters, which in the context of Teamsters were like real progressive. And they had an election in the spinach packing shed, and the PASO people and everybody in the whole community got involved in it, and they won. And as a result, they had elections in the county, and the Teamster PASO faction had won. This took place, I think it was in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
So PASO was, you know, a group that was attracting a lot of people. So, and particularly, it was like a workers' political movement in South Texas, Chicano scene. So in 1965, you know, they heard about the strike in California and the march in Delano and all that. And so there were two leaders of PASO in Starr County. One was named Lucille Galvan, and I can't remember the name of the other person, Doug. I can find out and let you know. But anyway, the two of them were involved. So they were friends with Chris, who was excited about Kennedy and the new resurgence of progressive liberal politics in Texas. And so he sent Gene to go meet with them. Well, the base of Paso and Starr County were farm workers. You know, that was their political base. And so Gene brought the message of the NFWA, and they brought the Paso and the workers, and they got together and they organized. I don't remember what the name of the group was, but in essence, I think they call it the NFWA too. Though at the time, Caesar wasn't real excited about another movement starting because he thought it would be a drain. But in any event, they...
A financial drain?
Financial drain on, or well, political and financial, whatever drain on the effort in California.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking money, California's half of agribusiness in this country. And there's no question about that. And if you're going to organize California, you can organize the rest of the country. And that was Caesar's focus, and I think he was correct in that. But in any event, you know, workers don't always understand those things, and they want to organize too. So I think it was on June the 1st in 1966, the workers in Starr County went out on strike against growers that were producing melons. And you had a lot of growers, a couple growers that were from California. La Casita Farms was a subsidiary of mm-hmm. Bud Andel and, you know, other growers. And then you had agribusiness, Trophy Farms that was...
What kind of farm?
Trophy Farms was the name of them. It was operated by Griffin and Brand. Of late, Othel Brand is the mayor of McAllen. He's a notorious right-wing jerk, you know. He's been on national TV. You probably know who he is. But he was a grower that operated them. Well, they went on strike against all those places. And the local workers who lived in Starr County, you know, went out on strike, and they're on the picket line. Well, and just within walking distance was Mexico. And so the growers started recruiting scabs from Mexico. And it's almost the same situation that we had in California, except it was smaller and it was closer. And, you know, everybody knew each other, too, on both sides of the border. So it was a real community upheaval. And on July 4th...
In other words, it was like family member against family member, almost.
In some senses, yeah. But it was across border. I mean,
right.
Families were straddled the border. I mean, the river was just, you know, kind of a, you know, thing that had to be crossed. I mean, there's a lot of goings on back and forth across the border there. And to this day, you know, there is. And so almost immediately, well, two things happened. The melon season was over with, and the fields in Starr County remained dormant pretty much through the summer because it's too hot to grow anything. And then they start with bell peppers and lettuce and other things later on. And then the other, they had scabbed the end of the melon strike. So they had to do something to keep the workers together and keep the momentum going. And so they started a march to Austin, Texas on July the 4th in 1966. In the meantime, we were doing the Georgia election in California.
Were they sort of copying the march to Sacramento?
They're basically copying the same thing. Only there were other kinds of people that got involved. There was a Catholic priest named Father Gonzalez, and then a Baptist minister, a Chicano Baptist minister, that joined with Gene Nelson and the strikers and led the march to Austin. Navarro was the name of the Baptist minister.
Navarro?
Navarro, yeah.
Okay.
I forgot his first name. I know him, I just can't recall his first name. But not a bad guy. Anyway, as the march progressed, there were different perceptions that were brought in about what the march was all about. I think Father Gonzalez and Reverend Navarro had an idea, you know, that they were the leaders of the Chicano civil rights movement a la King and Abernathy and so on, and they mm-hmm. envisioned that, and being out of the religious, you know, the Christian religious background, when money was raised for the strike, they wanted to keep it, you know, and they thought they were better prepared to disperse it or whatever, and then Gene was militantly representing what he, you know, perceived as the workers, and that the money should be, you know, dispersed to the union, and there was a fight all the way up on the march going to Austin. But that's when John Conley and Ben Barnes, who was and Wagner Carr, who were the leading Democratic people, and they were in the, by that time, from our perceptions, would be considered conservatives, they came mm-hmm. up and told the workers to go back. Of course, this is a New Braunfels, almost to Austin, and nobody's going to go back, you know. So they had a large number of workers that actually marched the whole way and would have rallies and went into Corpus Christi or San Antonio and so on, and had big rallies in all these towns all the way up. And actually, I think the march in Texas had equal or larger impact on things. And the first march in Delano, you know, from Delano to Sacramento, I think it was the first, and it captured a lot of people's imagination, workers and progressives and unions and so on. Mm-hmm. And in Texas, just, you know, the nature of Texas is a little bit different. People responded more, and we ended up with a bigger rally in Austin, actually, than we even had in Sacramento. And it just brought a lot of working class elements into that whole movement that less organized, but still, you know, less organized than, say, California, but still, you know, the ingredients of a real movement. And it was so new there compared to, you know, the traditions and the kinds of union struggles that we had in California that I think it had a bigger impact on people in Texas, a more lasting impact. And because it was, you know, a UFW or a farm worker thing, I think, you know, it wasn't just seen as a liberal or progressive thing. It was really seen workers. I think it had a much bigger impact on how people that were affected by that, you know, became active in politics later on.
Do you think there was, like, then there was more of a community? It covered more ground as far as who became involved. Yeah. What other types of groups did come and become involved?
Well, you had the, at that time, the Catholic Church was going through a struggle, which eventually led to the liberation theology types and the conservatives and so on. And so a lot of people that, you know, like me, were affected by Pope John and what that meant, you know, and Patchen and Terrace and all the different things, got involved. And so you had Curcio groups in Texas getting involved. And this was like the first time. In California, you had people that were already involved in things, right? So they had formed perceptions. But in Texas, this march form perceptions, you know, and it had a much bigger effect. And I've organized in both states, and I think there was, Texas is certainly more people tuned in with what farm workers and this whole thing meant than there were in California. In California, we were competing with movements. In Texas, you know, in a sense, we had a monopoly on the movement. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a big difference. But in any event, I was in the process of, we were returning the voters from to Georgia in El Paso about the time that the march reached Austin. And, you know, it was in the newspapers in El Paso, you know, 700 miles away, 800 miles away. It was a big deal. And I had gone to El Paso once to work once, never did get to work. Somebody, one of my friends said...
What, to organize? Or?
No, years ago. I mean, years before, we had gone over there to work in cotton. And, so, you know, this friend of ours who was from Texas, from El Paso, you know, wanted all of us to go over there and work and make a lot of money, that you can make money because it's the rare kind of cotton, was that. We went over there, and of course we couldn't get a job because they were getting people from Mexico, and they didn't want a bunch of, you know, Chicano and Anglo and kids, you know. Mm-hmm. But we hung out there, and that was my first experience with El Paso, and it just fascinated me. So when we went back from dropping the workers off in Juarez, by that time, I think Gene Nelson had convinced Caesar that, you know, the effort in Texas should be part of the UFW. Well, Caesar had gone to the rally in Austin, and Kircher went, and a lot of other people. And of course, the labor movement in Texas was extremely excited about it, and the church people. And Caesar couldn't tell them no, you know.
So he came. Did back Caesar send you there to see what was going on and try and stop it at one time? Or?
Well, I don't know what the initial thing. His thing was to send Gilbert there, and so Gilbert and I were hanging around together. And we were going there. Well, Gilbert had an alcoholic problem at the time, and he was drunk as a skunk, you know. And his wife was very upset about it, and just, you know, turmoil. And somebody had to go to Texas immediately, so Tony Orendine decided he wanted to go. So I was already had my mind made up. I wanted to go to Texas. So Tony and Irene and I took off to Texas. Mm-hmm. And the first day we were there, we drove up to the picket line and ran into a striker by the name of Magdaleno Dimas. And he had a 1940 Chevrolet that was, you know, to me, quite a car. You know, I like old cars. And so, I mean, we were there 10 minutes. Gene Nelson was on the line, and, you know, workers all over the place with the picket line and stuff. And they had just started in on... bell peppers, I think that's what they were doing. Anyway, Magdaleno took us to the back of his car, and he opens up the trunk, and it's full of dynamite. He had the perfect solution to the strike. And needless to say, I mean, it was a shock. And Tony, having, you know, been in Mexico and worked in mines and stuff for a short period of time, knew what dynamite was all about. And this stuff was dry and it was old. And so the very first thing Tony did was, you know, go with Magdaleno to dump the stuff in the river, you know, get rid of it. And the very first thing we did was convince Magdaleno that throwing dynamite at scabs wouldn't be too cool, you know.
So there was an initial philosophy going on there to have a violent confrontation with the scabs?
I think that was more Magdaleno's idea than anything else, and Gene wasn't real convinced of nonviolence anyway. So, mm-hmm. So I think he was prepared to tolerate that.
Was there, or how strong was the ideology between violence and nonviolence?
In Texas, that hadn't been a discussion at all among workers or anything. Gene was not into nonviolent organizing in
as
any
Caesar
deep sense.
Was.
And really, Caesar at that time wasn't particularly, I mean, it wasn't a major thing. But I think everybody had good sense that, you know, I mean, you're going to attract all kinds of problems throwing dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were throwing rocks at scabs and slingshots and... Actually, that was not uncommon, I know, by the way.
Even though it's not said too often.
I mean, that's right. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that went on in the San Joaquin Valley. That sheds that burned and all kinds of things that the growers thought we did. And of course, they couldn't prove it. But there's a lot of stuff that went on. And in the very early days, it was pretty rampant.
Right. Could you give me a couple of examples of that?
Well, I remember being on picket lines in Delano with a bunch of kids with slingshots and BB guns and all kinds of things that were tolerated.
Who were we popping them off at?
At scab.
Not at the thugs hired by the growers?
They went after them. Some of the enragements resulted from a BB in the butt or something. Some of the more famous attacks on strikers with somebody's BB gun. Yeah, or a slingshot or a rock or whatever. And that, that is not a negative criticism. It's just something that happened. And I think that in Texas, you know, at the point when Tony and I drove up to the picket line, when, you know, early in the morning, that, you know, the worker solution was to do that. You know, that was the thing that...
Well, slingshots versus dynamite is a major step.
Well, if you knew Magdaleno, you would understand.
Yeah.
So. Anyway...
What was his character like?
He was a pretty... rowdy person, and he had been involved in smuggling. There was a lot of smuggling that went on, and at the time when Tony and I went there, we were unaware of the dynamics of all of that.
Across the border?
Yeah, between the United States and Mexico, and Magdaleno actually was smuggling dope for the sheriff's department in Starr County, you know, before he went to work at La Casita, and then got involved in the strike, and I think we kept him clean maybe for about a year, you know, but he was a pretty notorious character. Along the border, a very powerful personality. He's dead now, so we can talk about him. He did a lot of bizarre things.
But still fought for the workers, the farm worker.
He was a worker, he was a striker. And
he was also a worker.
Oh, yeah. He worked at La Casita and went out on strike with those workers at La Casita. So after that, I think later on that day, I went to join the picket line at Trophy Farms. Well, no sooner than I arrived there, the sheriffs came and arrested me and put me in jail for making obscene comments or something to workers. I hadn't said anything. I just drove up and got out of my car. I was talking with the pickets, and all of a sudden here comes the sheriff and arrests me. What is this? And they're after, you know, me and Tony. You know,
so they knew you were in
outside
town.
Outside agitators coming in, you know.
Okay, they had heard you were coming into town then and that
stuff. Everybody knew everything about everybody in Starr County. It was just... You know, you couldn't say anything or do anything without everybody knowing.
With your first day in town?
Yeah. I mean, they knew we were coming because Gene had mentioned it at a meeting, I guess the previous Friday or whenever, you know, they had their meetings.
The union was infiltrated to a degree.
No, I don't think it was really infiltrated. And I think people just talk a lot. You know,
it's a small town.
Small town. You have a town with less than 6,000 population, a county with about 25,000 population. And most of it along the border, you know, concentrated in serious.
So both of you were put in jail?
Tony wasn't at that time, but I was. And I guess that was to try to deter us from settling in, but that just, you know, made us want to do it more, you know. And it pissed off the workers, and, you know, it started polarizing things more than it had been before.
How long were you in jail?
Oh, it was probably, at that time, I think it was, you know, 4 or 5 hours. There was a dynamic going there. Again, you had the Paso people, you had the new party, and then you had the old party, and it turned out, for various reasons, the old party decided it was time to ally themselves with something new, and so they aligned themselves with us in Star County.
Oh, okay.
And they started posting bond for us. You know? So they were property Chicanos, you know, that lived on the western side of Star County, and the new party people were in Rio Grande City. They're in Roma, which was the only incorporated town in Star County, and then Rio Grande City to this day is unincorporated, but the people who control the county control Rio Grande City, and then the minority faction controls the government of Roma. And those are fought over because at Roma you have a bridge that goes to the city of Miguel Alemán. Those are smuggling points. And then in Rio Grande City you have a bridge that goes to Camargo, you know, which is another smuggling point. Whoever controls the bridges controls the smuggling thing. And, you know, whoever's elected, the county ran the bridge, the American side of the bridge in Rio Grande City, and then the city of Roma ran the bridge on the American side in Roma. So.
And, okay, what happened after you got out of jail?
Oh, we continued organizing, and we decided, you know, we had to draw attention to the fact that scabs were being recruited from Mexico. And so we organized a demonstration on the bridge in Roma, which was on, by that time we perceived that as friendlier turf. And I think at some point, Gene wanted to you see, there are gates on the bridges, you know, where they could close them between Mexico and the United States. Gene had wanted to go lock the bridge, you know, get some big padlocks and change and close the gates and lock the bridge to keep people from coming back and forth, you know, keep the scabs from coming across. And Tony and I talked him out of doing that, and, you know, talked him into having a demonstration to draw attention to the strike breaking along the border. So, like around 3 or 4 in the morning, Irene and I and Tony and Gene and a whole bunch of workers went to the bridge, and we walked out on it. We parked the cars and walked out on the bridge and set up a picket line. And the people on the American side were half asleep, and they didn't really pay attention to us, didn't look at us or anything. And it was maybe about an hour after we were there, and I guess they woke up to the fact that there was no traffic coming back across from Mexico, and they came out and looked at us, and U.S. immigration, and, you know, they ordered us off the bridge, and we told them no. And at that point, everybody sat down on the bridge, you know. And it got more dramatic. There were brick trucks, you know, bricks are produced in Mexico and brought to the United States and sold, and then a couple of them that were on the bridge on the Mexican side parked because, you know, we wouldn't let them by. And, I guess we were out there 4 hours before, you know, the city of Roma police wouldn't do anything with us, you know, so they liked us, right? They wouldn't come and arrest us, so they called the county sheriffs to come and arrest us, and those were the new party people, right? So they came in and begged us, you know, to get off the bridge, and we wouldn't, so.
How many of you were there on the bridge?
Oh, probably about 20. I guess they were actually blocking, and then just literally hundreds of workers, you know, from both sides were on the bridge watching, you know. By that time, it was 9 or 10 in the morning by then. And so they came and, well, the first person they arrested was Gene Nelson. And so they arrested him, and he went limp, and they dragged him down the bridge, and he lost his shoes and his belt, and his pants started coming down and all that. And I guess they thought by arresting Nelson, everybody would get scared and get off the bridge. Well, they waited and waited and waited, and nothing happened. Well, then they went after me and Tony and did the same thing, except they had brought the cars up closer on the bridge. We weren't dragged like Gene was. And nothing happened. Then they went after the mail workers and arrested all of them. And I think Irene and a woman named Daria Vera were the only ones that were left. And I guess they begged them for hours to get up off the bridge, you know, and then it started raining, and Irene or Daria had a red flag, the Huelga flag, and the dye started running out of the flag, and workers thought the cops had attacked the women, you know, and they were getting outraged, you know, just, and by that time we had media there from Mexico, from all along the border, and it was just a big international incident. It was real exciting. They finally arrested Irene and Darien. Maybe about noon or 1 o'clock, they were able to let people across the bridge, but it created a big incident and got, you know, international publicity all over the place about it. We had people send us clippings from Mexico and, you know, Central America and from Holland and, you know, different countries, that the picture of, you know, the picket line on the bridge. So that became a major issue in the strike after that. It was, you know, the international strike breaking.
Mm-hmm. So this tactic is now going to be used in other times, other places?
Well, I think a week after that, Gene finally, he couldn't contain himself. He got his locks and his chains and locked the bridge. And that really pissed him off. And they were banging away, you know. People went out to sneak a look. It took him about 3 or 4 hours, and he had huge chains, and they couldn't cut them or break them with a sledgehammer or anything. You know? And he finally got a dream of locking the bridge.
And how long were you in Texas?
That stint, I was there a little over a year. We'd come in September, mid-September, and then I think I left the end of September in 1967. And we were in California relatively briefly. I think in early 68 we went to, no, it was after the fast, we went to Ohio to organize the boycott.
The first fast?
Julio and, yeah, the first fast. We were there for the first fast.
At 40 acres.
Right, yeah. Oh, wait a minute, I'm leaving stuff out. Yeah, so we went back to California in September of 67.
And so for the year that you were in Texas, you were there organizing?
No, we were organizing workers.
Workers?
Yeah. We went on
just
to,
in that one area, or were you going all over Texas?
Well, at that point, we were trying to win in the strike, and everything we did was focused around the strike, and we started a boycott of melons. And this is when Ernie Cortez got involved. Ernie got involved. He was a student at the University of Texas, or a graduate student there. He'd gone to Texas A&M and then went to UT to run the YMCA thing that they had for the students at UT, and was a graduate student there. And Ernie got involved with some other students in a support committee that we had in Austin, and then Mickey Leland, who later became a congressman, was involved at Texas Southern University in a support group for farm workers in the Rio Grande Valley. And we had a network, and we started the
Melon. So you were networking through the universities, students?
Through the students and through PASO chapters, you know, labor groups, all kinds of people. And we had a very, I think, a very effective network that, you know, laid the foundation for, you know, the boycott work in Texas in the next, over the next 10 years, you know. And in Texas, we had one of the most effective grape boycotts or lettuce boycotts or whatever, you know, in the country.
Can you do a comparison for me? I had been reading a lot on the, we had a couple of researchers coming in doing work on the CSO here in Los Angeles. And so I started reading the comparisons between the, I don't know the name of the group in Texas.
Oh, this is later?
God, was it later or earlier?
The Ernie Cortez stuff, the Industrial Areas Foundation work?
Yeah, the Industrial Areas Foundation. The successes there versus maybe what I would consider maybe the moderate successes here, I guess it depends on who's looking at who. The different base organizations leading more to Mexican-Americans in political leadership positions in Texas as compared to Southern California, say?
I think in Southern California, I really don't remember all the dynamics of the CSO. It started right after World War II, and I think that, you know, Fred Ross had worked with Kerry McWilliams in the labor camps, the camps with the Japanese were put in. And prior to that, they had been involved in the labor camps together in the 30s, you know, when the Okies came and all that, when Woody Guthrie and all that was around. And I think that Saul Linsky had started the Back of the Yards organization in Chicago. And what he did, he went around to existing organizations of all kinds, churches, unions, and so on, anything that exists in the community, to create a council of the organizations to deal with the problems. The CSO model was very different. It instead of dealing with existing organizations in the community, it created one of its own, you know. And Ed Roybal was the first leader of that, and he ran for the city council and so on.
Right.
But it competed with other organizations in East Los Angeles. And I think that, I don't know, in retrospect, to me, I would think that might have been a mistake, because had they built a council in East LA, I think the political dynamics would have been much different in East Los Angeles today than it is now. You still have, in East LA, a whole lot of competing organizations, and
right.
I think that's an organizational and political problem
that you didn't see in Texas.
Well, not necessarily. There wasn't a lot of work done in Texas in an organized sense like in East Los Angeles.
Right.
But, the political work in East LA, you had right after World War II and before World War II, you had a very active socialist and broad socialist kind of element in East Los Angeles. They were either communists or socialists or Trotskyites or whatever. And a lot of that was spillover from Mexico that was there, just like in the earlier period in the Mexican Revolution and before, there were political spillovers from Mexico mm-hmm. into East Los Angeles. And so you had a lot of ingredients there. The organizations came and went. The political groups came and went. So there were a lot of people that were there in East LA to form a Communist Party chapter or whatever, and they were very strong at one point in that area there. And that's CSO. CSO started as, an outgrowth from the Industrial Areas Foundation, and Alinsky by that time, fell into red baiting. And so you had the CSO that started as a counter, or it became a counter to the Communist Party activity in East Los Angeles. And there's a lot of red baiting. Fred Ross was a heavy red baiter, and when Caesar got involved, that wasn't part of the atmosphere that was in CSO. Mm-hmm. So they were competing with the left, they're competing with some of the more mainline political organizations that were attached to the Democratic Party or to county supervisors or whatever, because East LA was a county. It's not.
So your work in Texas didn't really see that same
competition. There wasn't that thing. In San Antonio there was, because again, San Antonio was like a staging area for Mexican politics. So you had a Communist
right.
Party in San Antonio, and you had socialists and, liberal party people and whatnot, that were there.
But they weren't helping the farm workers particularly. Yes,
well, they did.
They did.
They all did, yeah. And they did, later on in East LA. But in East LA, Caesar had organized in East LA to compete with people who, eventually, because of their principles, ended up supporting the farm workers and being allies.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, that all of that contributed to what Doug and I and others talk about, the paranoia that existed later on in the UFW, where, the early days of the UFW was a very inclusive thing where people, were accepted.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe that paranoia, the contrast with the early period of togetherness versus what now you say is in the later period is paranoia with
the
UFW?
Particularly during the 70s, to me there was a lot of paranoia and fear that somebody with some agenda was going to take over. And that led to the dissolving of the whole boycott apparatus they had around the country, because they thought Nick Jones and Virginia Jones were running this national thing that's going to come and take over the union. And in fact, they weren't. They were just doing work, and they were good organizers, and had good boycott operation going.
Now, who were they?
Nick first came to the UFW through as, or heard about it when he was in the Students for Democratic Society in the early 60s
and he's
in the
from
Midwest.
Where?
Originally,
Detroit?
I think from North Dakota or South Dakota,
okay.
One of those states.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember where he went to school, but anyway, he ended up in Delano in 1966. And when we were organizing, I don't remember what it was, but anyway, he was in Fresno. And I'm sure that he knew Jorge at that time.
Jorge Garcia?
Yeah, they must have known each other. Virginia Rodriguez worked in a poverty program. She was like a secretary. Mm-hmm. And the people who were running the poverty program were sympathetic to Caesar. And so that became a covert headquarters for the UFW in Fresno. So Nick and Virginia got together, and they fell in love and got married and so on. And Virginia then became Caesar's secretary later on, I think late 66, 67. And
mm-hmm.
For a number of years, she did that, and Nick was organized.
Were at 40 Acres?
Before, when we were in Delano, in the Pink
the
House.
I'm trying to think of the name of the street. It's right,
first
right down the block off
Albany,
of the entrance.
First in
yeah.
Albany, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she worked at that time. Then after DiGiorgio. Oh, it was in... Oh, I know. Yeah, Nick and I worked together in 67 when I came back from Texas.
From Texas.
Yeah. And then we went out on the boycott together the spring, summer, whenever it was, in 68.
And where did you go for the boycott?
I can't remember where. I think you went to Kansas. I went to Ohio. And... But in between, there were a lot of things that happened. That's when the fast took place, and I was involved with the fast, mm-hmm. and so was Nick. And Virginia.
Nick and Virginia set up the vision, didn't they?
Yeah, basically they did. They're the ones that did the work. And then Leroy Chatfield, who brought in a very different kind of ingredient into it, more of the more of the church stuff. But I think that.
So when
that,
they went back to the Midwest or Kansas.
I'm getting chronologically a little mixed up, but
yeah.
Basically, when we came back from Texas, you know, the perception was, well, we had a whole lot of incidents in Texas with the Rangers. We were in jail for 8 days, and I don't know, mm-hmm. you want to go into
yeah.
that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, after, let me see, we had...
But at some point in time, I want to get back to this issue of the paranoia that
yeah.
hit the Union, but back to Texas and the Texas Rangers.
Back to Texas, after that October demonstration, we began trying to set up a boycott apparatus to prepare for the next, big harvest season.
The melon
was the big money crop. They would grow a variety of vegetables, bell peppers and cabbage, in the fall, onions and all kinds of things that they could do. But the real money they made was off of melons. Texas melons, there's nothing like them. California cannot grow melons or Florida like they do in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So that they are the premium of melon, all the focus was around trying to, figure out a way to win the strike with the 1967 melon harvest. And we had Gilbert Padilla, well, by then there were some problems with Tony. Tony was getting frustrated, and I think it was November or December, sometime around that in the winter, Gilbert came in ostensibly to help Tony and me, get ready. And then Jim Drake came too, briefly.
Mm-hmm.
I think even Jerry Cohen may have come. And George Ballas came. Eddie Frankel. Let's see who else came. A number of people came, for a very...
So we're looking at a very major move here by the farm workers.
Yeah, the decision was made to try to win the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So in the springtime, a lot of the work was to set up the network or reinforce the network that Tony and I had attempted to start when Ernie Cortez was involved and Mickey Leland and Chris Dixie, of course, was involved in Houston, too. They had mm-hmm. a real good committee there. They're raising money and, for us consistently. And Ernie was doing the same in Austin. They'd had food caravans coming in. And there was a priest named Cheryl Smith and a number of other priests in San Antonio. Cheryl Smith, yeah, Father Cheryl Smith. He's kind of notorious now in the Right to Life movement in Texas. But he was a progressive priest. And, some of the communist types, from San Antonio, they're all working together to support us, all of them. And were the Sagers, a guy named Jaime Sager and Mela Sager. Their son, Jaime Jr., was involved in the boycott in Los Angeles. He was involved with MAPA
mm-hmm.
and so on, and I had met him first.
Is that... C-I-G-A-R?
Yes. Sager. He teaches in Oakland, or up in the Bay Area with some school up there.
I'm trying to
and
think. There's another labor Sager that I'm trying to think of from the Jewish Labor Committee or something like
no,
that.
No, he wouldn't be in that. The Jewish Labor Committee would not have those folks at all. They're all...
Yeah.
I mean, when I met Jaime, he was a member of the Du Bois Club and all of that here in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's something we didn't talk about. Angela Davis used to come and picket at the Central. We used to get students to come join us.
When you're down at the Central...
Yeah.
And
there's the SDS. Mike Davis, who you may know.
Right. Yeah, I know Mike Davis.
And,
I'm on a panel with Mike Davis next week. But, crap.
Mike is an old friend.
Oh, we're going to try and change
his fuse. Probably blow his mind.
Yeah.
Anyway, Mike, and he was like the leader of the SDS at USC or something, and then Franklin Alexander... who you probably know, just recently died. He was in the Longshore Union. He was a leader in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. But I think he was a student at UCLA or someplace like that. And he led the Du Bois Club. Mm-hmm. And Angela Davis was a student at that time. All those people used to come and picket with us in the Central Market. And you could call any of them any time of the night, and they would show up, you know, very rapidly.
Well, just a second. Let me put this on pause. Let's see, where did we left off just after Eugene Nelson had locked the gates to the bridge, and you said you were another what year?
Well, still in during Texas, the that was November of '66, mm-hmm. and the main thing then became to try to build the kind of support we needed among workers, and then outside to try to win the strike with the melons.
Right.
In between, we were picketing cabbage and lettuce and things like that, and there were arrests during the strike. I think I was arrested altogether maybe six times during the strike, and a lot of workers were arrested more on the picket lines. And it almost became a joke because these are these new party people and they're clearly incompetent, you know, in law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And really their expertise was in other things, you know. And most of the people saw them as buffoons. And it became almost a comedy in a way, some of the arrests that took place. But in the spring, as things heated up, we tried to stop the bell peppers. I guess that was the big thing. And we had gotten support from the railroad unions, and they had agreed to honor the picket lines. So we started picking the railroad sidings, and they would get off the trains, and supervisors would come and take them across. And we had one incident. The siding went up from McAllen, Texas, all the way to Rio Grande City, and it was one way in and then one way out. And we had been picketing the trains, and I guess we had been able to hold the train full of peppers for about a week. And they got the supervision in, and they were going to take them out. And suddenly a railroad trestle over a little canyon caught on fire and burned. And
how did it catch on fire?
Well, who knows? But there was somebody that showed up that night that just reeked of gasoline, and we mm-hmm. sent him off to take a bath and get cleaned up because we thought they would choose him as the one that had set the bridge. But actually, they could never find who set the bridge on fire.
Mm-hmm.
But it kept the train full of bell peppers there for, you know, a good while longer while they rebuilt the trestle. You know. So, was, you know, those kinds of things were going on. But when it finally was able to go, we were still picketing, and the Rangers came and arrested a bunch of us in Rio Grande City, and then other people. Pancho Medrano, who we've talked about before, he was an activist in the United Auto Workers Union. He was on Walter Reuther's staff. And he, along with some others, were arrested in the lower part of the Rio Grande Valley while picketing. And that arrest led to a lawsuit, you know, Pancho Medrano and a bunch of us, you know, that were plaintiffs, against the anti-picketing law that we had in Texas. And we were able to get that overturned eventually in the U.S. Supreme Court. It was, I guess, around 1972 that we actually got the decision on that. But that was just like a prelude to the activity in the springtime.
Right. What were the main goals of the strike?
Well, most of the people were making less than $1 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there was a goal for $1.25 an hour minimum, you know, which was significantly lower than California. And it led to a political movement in the legislature to get a minimum wage law passed in Texas for $1.25 an hour, and bills were introduced and so on. Texas did have a minimum wage law, but it was 35 cents an hour. It had been passed when Henry B. Gonzalez was a state senator, and he initiated and got it passed in the late 50s sometime.
And it hadn't been?
It hadn't been raised at all, although the federal minimum wage was like $1 an hour by then.
Any other goals?
Well, to win contracts with the growers, mm-hmm. you know, the usual, you know, trade union kinds of goals that we had. Mm-hmm.
Could you give a description of the work conditions and the living conditions that the workers were working under?
Well, the working conditions were terrible. People were up in the morning and before daybreak were already working the fields, and they would not.
Okay, Bill, you were talking about the living conditions and the fields?
The working conditions were very bad. They didn't have the structured labor contractor situation like in California, but they had crew leaders, and there was probably less of the sexual harassment that went on and things like that with women workers, because people knew each other there, as opposed to California, where, you know, mm-hmm. people came from somewhere and worked there and went off somewhere else. But in Texas, people knew each other, and there was a little bit more respect for women there, but not much.
And could you give a little more detail about the California scene on the respect for women versus the Texas scene?
My experience, you know, in observing it and being a worker in the 50s, it was on the most blatant form of sexual harassment and forcing, you know, women to perform sexual favors and so on with contractors. It was all over, and there's rampant prostitution in the camps, particularly where you had situations like, the Filipinos, when they were brought over during the 1920s and 30s, just men were brought over, and mm-hmm. then the anti-miscegenation laws they had in California at that time prevented them from marrying. So, I mean, there was always prostitution in the Filipino camps, and of course everywhere else. You know, there was just for us, not because of the prostitution, but the Filipino camps, because they were actual communities as opposed to the others. There are better places to be. You had better food, better accommodations, and so on. Mm-hmm. But the poor men, you know, by that time they were older. They had no families, nothing, you know, except the prostitutes, who in effect, in their camps, became part of a very loose extended family, because they had all hung out together for years. You know. Mm-hmm. But in the other camps, with people coming from Mexico and other places like that, you had a more, you know, blatantly commercialized prostitution than was operated by the contractors.
It was operated by the contractors.
Yeah, they're the ones that got the women there, and yeah.
Okay.
And then in all the towns like Delano and Bakersfield, all the little farm worker towns, they all had, you know, very open red light districts all the way through into the 60s. Marysville, you know, wherever, you know.
So part of the union's activities were ending that?
I think, you know, ending the, you know, everything that the contractor, you know, everything that that implied. Mm-hmm. I don't think at first it was conscious to end prostitution or end sexual harassment or anything, but that was part of the effects of the system that they had in California. They still do.
Okay. After Texas, how long were you in Texas for a year?
I was in Texas a little over a year at mm-hmm. that time.
And then you come back to California?
Yeah, I was back in California. When we had the effort with the melons in the late spring of 1967, mm-hmm. that's when things really got intense, and we had some police brutality on the part of the rangers and the sheriff's deputy. Mm-hmm. But the significant thing, we were organizing the support from the unions in Mexico, and we during that period we helped a number of the unions organize in brick factories and other places, and built solidarity networks on both sides. And mm-hmm. the idea was to try to get the people from Mexico to help stop the recruitment of strike breakers across the border, and then eventually to picket the border on both sides. We're going to have picket lines, because at that time in Mexico, if you set up a picket line, it was illegal to cross a picket line. And we were hopeful that, you know, the Mexicans could stop the flow of scabs during the melon season. We figured we needed probably 2 to 3 weeks of just shutting it down, and we would have the growers. And in the meantime, we were setting up a very well-organized boycott in mm-hmm. Texas and other places where the Texas melons went at that time, Chicago and other St. Louis and the other Midwestern cities. And when the melon season came and we were, you know, striking, they brought in probably about 35 Texas Rangers, which was more than half of the entire force in Texas. Mm-hmm. And they're staying at the Fort Ringgold Hotel and working out of there. And they were you know, throwing their weight around all over the place. And,
did I read somewhere that they busted the Union Hall several times?
Well, what happened was that we had a strike kitchen, and you know, every we'd have breakfast and dinner there. Then a number of the wives of the strikers would cook the meal and so on. And we had a kind of a rowdy striker named Magdaleno Dimas who loved to go hunting, and so we sent him and some other people out to go, you know, get meat and stuff, and they would shoot different animals and bring them back, and, you know, part of the tacos that we ate.
Mm-hmm.
And one day his car didn't work, and so he and another guy named Benny Rodriguez were going, they were walking out to go hunting, and this was during the melon campaign in 67, and I guess one of the growers saw them walking with a gun and got very paranoid and called the sheriffs and the rangers and so on. And so Gilbert Padilla and I and a guy, a student named Alex Moreno, were, a couple other people were outside of the Union Hall, and we were hanging around talking, leaning on the cars and stuff. And all of a sudden the Texas Rangers drove up, a couple carloads, and they just jumped out of the cars, and they had shotguns or, you know, some kind of rifles, and they leveled them at us and demanded to know where Magdaleno Dimas was. And we didn't know what had happened or, you know, where he was or anything. And so we told them that, and they called us liars and pushed people around, and then they finally took off. So we decided we better warn his family that they're looking for him, and if they see him, you know, just get him off the street. So Alex and I went to his house and told his wife what was going on and let her know what to do. And then we went to a house with some students that had come from the University of Texas, another place we're staying, to see if he might be over there, and to tell the students that, you know, to be wary of what was happening. And so we went to the house, and we went inside, and not only were the students there, but Magdalena was there. And we told him what was happening, and we said, well, you'd be better, instead of walking home by yourself, you know, to come with us, and we'll take you home, even though it's 3 or 4 blocks from there. And so we, as we came out of the house, lights turned on all over the place, and we saw all these rangers and deputies with their rifles and pistols and mm-hmm. aimed at us. And Magdalena was walking out, and it was myself, and well, Alex first, and myself, then Magdalena. And I knew that Magdalena had the rifle. And I thought that all that they needed was to see that, and then they would open fire. And so I told him to drop the thing and, you know, get rid of it quick, you know. And so he dropped it, but instead of standing still, he turned around and went back in the house. Well, they grabbed Alex and me, and they started beating on us. And Alex fell on top of me, and they're beating on Alex and really beating up pretty bad. I was protected by him, you know. And then they handcuffed us and threw us in the car. And then they went after Magdaleno, and they broke all the windows in the house to get in and beat up him and Benny Rodriguez, and there was a couple other people in the house, and they hid like under the sink in places, and mm-hmm. a couple of girls and so on. But they got Benny and Magdaleno, and were just beating them up as they were dragging them out to the cars. And when we got into the county courthouse where the jail was, they had us lined up, the four of us, Magdaleno and Benny and Alex and myself. And Magdaleno was bleeding, and they started cussing him out because his blood was getting their floor dirty, and it made him get a rag and clean up his own blood. Just Jesus. Very brutal. And so they eventually put us in the jail, but that was enough to trigger an outrage, you know, about the ranger. Eventually, you know, everybody got out, and we never went to trial. But the next day, they brought us to arraignment. There was a state senator there named Joe Bernal who had come in to witness the arraignment.
Mm-hmm.
And he started to raise questions before the hearing started. And Captain A.Y. Ali of the Rangers grabbed him by the neck and just pulled him out of the chair. And, "Don't you ever talk to a white man like that," you know. And threw the senator down. You know, he's a Chicano senator, the only one, you know, in Texas. They were pretty mean. But And Gilbert Padilla was there. And he was trying to get us out of jail, and he went in the courthouse and went where we were when we were standing there. And the Rangers got him, and they picked him up and carried him down the hall and threw him out, literally just threw him out of the courthouse. And the Justice of the Peace, whose precinct that was in, that we were at the arraignment in the next day, he wanted to know what was going on. They threw him out of his own courthouse. And there was Gilbert and I think his name is Braulio Sanchez, sitting on the steps of the courthouse, and the Rangers wouldn't even let the JP in his own courthouse. You
know? Jeez.
A lot of people.
Did that end up getting enough national attention to
that triggered
help the rest of the work for the organizing?
That brought the Senate Subcommittee on Migratory Labor and Ted Kennedy and Harrison Williams and a couple other senators to conduct a hearing and investigation on what was going on. It was very dramatic, and workers came and testified about all the things that happened. We had another incident that I forgot to tell you about in November of 66, and it was associated with the Bell Peppers, and they had gone, and we were doing some picketing. I can't remember what the issue was. I think it was we violated an injunction, so they arrested a bunch of us and put us in the courthouse, and we were up on the third floor of the courthouse, and the courthouse was on a big hill in Rio Grande City, and you could look out and see all around the city. And the perception among the strikers at that time was that they were going to, kidnap us and kill us, because they heard, the stories of the Rangers doing that to people that were arrested. So a lot of them got together on their own and decided they're going to get us out of the, bust us out of jail. And so a bunch of them, you could see them coming with guns and all this stuff.
But how many were in
the
street?
Oh, there must have been 50 or 60 workers, coming. Mm-hmm. And, then I could see further down, I could see the sheriff's cars and the Rangers' car just kind of parked around town. And so we started, Tony Orendine and I were in jail, and we started sending notes out. Irene and others were outside the courthouse, so we started throwing notes written on toilet paper out the window about, hey, they're gonna shoot these workers. We need to do something else. We need to have, a vigil or a fast or something. And so by the time the workers got close to the courthouse, Irene and some of the others met with them and talked with them and persuaded them to put away their guns and to join a vigil. So they all started praying, and they had a vigil around the courthouse, and then they had like a march. More and more workers came. There was a march around the courthouse, and they kept a vigil there for the 8 days that we were in jail. They refused us bail for a number of days, and finally publicity built, and they let us out. But, it was, the Rangers thought that they were going to create an incident that would be to their advantage and knock off some people in the process. And, thanks to quick thinking, it didn't happen. And the television was there. There was an Associated Press reporter who covered the strike from beginning to end. His name was Gary Garrison. And anytime anything happened, he was there, and he helped, get the national media in and so on and that. In that particular incident, well, all the others too, very helpful.
What was the outcome of the Edward Kennedy investigation?
Well, I think the big effect was it drew national attention to the injustices there. Mm-hmm. It led to a contract that we had with a small melon grower who happened to be a Chicano member of the old party, and that contract lasted about as long as, the hurricane. Hurricane Beulah came in, I guess it was September of 67, just wiped everything out, and the contract lasted just a few months. I mean, there was no land. It was all washed away after that. But we never did get contracts out of those growers, and the perception from California was that, we did our best. We gave it our best shot, and now it's time to cut and get out.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically they did, and for a couple of years there was not really a lot of activity there until 1970.
And so then you came back to Delano?
After that, in 67, we went back to Delano, and we were involved in the organizing with the Jamara Vineyards.
Okay.
Nick Jones and Virginia Jones, myself, and I think Richard Chavez and some others were involved with trying to organize Jamara workers. And we had a we had had a strike at Jamara, and we had a boycott going from, I guess, 1966 after to Georgia, and Jamara was one of the big grape growers,
right.
And so we had a table grape boycott, and so all the original strikers were dispersed out on the boycott and, you know, mm-hmm. all over the country, and so what we're trying to do is organize people that have been brought in as strike breakers to try to put pressure, and we're organizing in Delano and Bakersfield and so on. And the idea was to make mischief for travesuras in the vineyards.
Mm-hmm.
And so we began focusing on the fact that Jamara had no toilets in the field. And we got workers to, we did a lot of things, but usually when there's no toilets and you're in the vineyards, you've got to take a shit or something, you go under the vines and you do it and you cover it up and or whatever, you know. And so what we were telling
people... Including the women.
Yeah, including the women. So what we're telling people to do, if they're doing that, you know, instead of doing that, take a shit in the box, put the grapes over it, and when they go to the store, you know. And so a lot of workers were doing that. And it was kind of comical because, you know, the stores were outraged when they got this, you know, about mm-hmm. these grapes, and they didn't want Jamara grapes anymore, and they were calling Jamara and raising hell. And we were hearing about it from the boycott. There, just stuff like that that they were doing. But also during that time, there was a lot of frustration among a lot of workers that had been strikers around Delano. And there was a lot of mischief that went beyond those kinds of things, you know, downright sabotage and mm-hmm. so on. And there were people who were known to have followed trainloads of grapes and would drive along the railroad routes with high-powered rifles and shoot out the thermostats on the refrigerator cart, and stuff like that was going on all over the place. And some workers we know were caught in Nevada by the California Highway Patrol and taken back into California and released. You know, don't you ever come back into Nevada again. Mm-hmm. People were riding trains all over the country doing stuff. And there's a lot of stuff that was going on. And so Epifanio Camacho got caught. And so the Kern County Grand Jury brought charges against Epifanio Camacho and I think Cesar Chavez and 125 John Does, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to have a big trial over, you know, the union violence. And that's when Cesar began his fast. It was the spring of 68.
It was in response to all the
violent,
union violence,
yeah.
then, or potential.
And it was a fast for nonviolence. And, mm-hmm. you know, that was a major turning point in the whole direction the union went. And I think workers really got into it.
Can you describe the atmosphere of the vigil and the fasting that was going on and how the union changed?
Well, Cesar began his fast. Well, it started with a meeting that they had with workers, and it was a big dispute about, you know, what was going on. There was a meeting in Filipino Hall. And Cesar announced that he'd been fasting for 2 or 3 days, and he basically was very disturbed about the violence, and he was going to go to the 40 acres, and he actually walked from the Filipino Hall out to the 40 acres and went into what was supposed to be the little office of the gas station and set up and began his fast. And then Nick and Virginia Jones and others, you know, began joining, you know, and people set up tents, and pretty soon, you know, workers came from all over and joined the fast, mm-hmm. and it became a religious experience for a lot of people. And I think, as Doug was mentioned yesterday, people actually walked on their knees all the way from Delano out Garces Highway to the... from some people's point of view, the whole thing became very bizarre, but there was almost like a carnival atmosphere around, but I think there were a lot mm-hmm. of people that were very serious about it, and I think it generated enough... it had a big enough effect on workers where, you know, the idea of nonviolent organizing and nonviolence, I think, really hit home. And so in that way, it was successful. And then, you know, when he broke his fast, Bobby Kennedy and other people came, and it was a big event.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it elevated Cesar, you know, I think from the role of an organizer to something else. And, of course, it changed the direction that workers were going in terms of, you know, violence versus nonviolence. And I think a lot of workers understood what nonviolence was all about. They got the message. But I think, you know, it had very positive results. And, of course, the grand jury thing from Kern County, you know, they couldn't do anything with it then. You know, just mm-hmm. politically impossible for them to deal with indicting Cesar, you know, who became something else in this process, and these workers. And, the image of that. So it basically, over a period of time, that indictment just petered out and nothing was done on it. But we would have, during the trial, we would have hundreds of workers in the courthouse when the trial was later. It was after the fast. Mm-hmm. And it was, that was a lot of fun because we'd get hundreds of workers inside the courthouse and people were very quiet. They didn't want to be thrown out of the courthouse. So they'd go and they'd line the walls outside the courtroom and then more workers came and then there's not enough room on the floor where the trial was taking place and so they started going on all the other floors. And pretty soon, as the days went by with the trial, there are literally hundreds of workers inside the courthouse and it just drove them nuts because they didn't say anything. They're just quiet. Like a vigil there, mm-hmm. During the hearings and stuff. And it was inconclusive. But hundreds of workers, they maintained the vigil during the trial, and the powers that be couldn't deal with it. And that was a manifestation of nonviolent organizing, and it worked. And I think that the fact that it actually worked in turning back, an attack on the union, it made a big impact on people.
So that the union now was more worldwide known as nonviolent.
Right. I think that hit home. It was in the spring of 68, spring and early summer, that mm-hmm. all of this took place.
How did that change negotiations for new contracts?
Well, that was a period where there weren't really negotiations going on. The growers had dug in. And, of course, the union, after that, I think the boycott took on a new meaning out in the cities. I think mm-hmm. people who were not used to the kinds of things that workers were began to identify with the union, and the boycott really began to take off, really, in 1968. So we then, with a lot of the Jamara workers that initially had been strike breakers and so on, they went out on the boycott in the early fall of 1968.
And where did you go starting in 68?
Julio and I and some others ended up in Ohio. But between that, there was something else, and that was there was a commitment made to support Bobby Kennedy for president.
Okay.
And we took, hundreds of workers to Los Angeles for the campaign. That was during the summer. First, there was a deadline in June or something for voter registration for the Democratic primary,
right.
it was May. We took a bunch of workers and to East Los Angeles to do a very intense voter registration campaign over about 3-week period. And Fred Ross organized it, and we were able to combine the resources of the Community Service Organization, Tony Rios and Ursula Gutierrez and all of them, who had members of that group that were deputy registrars, and then get workers there. Mm-hmm. And we hit all the supermarkets and shopping centers and areas where residents went. And in a three week period of time, we registered over 10,000 new voters in the East Los Angeles section.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the Democratic primary, at the end of the voter registration, we brought in hundreds of workers to spread out all over East LA, and we divided it up precinct by precinct, and we had precinct captains, and we did door-to-door neighborhood work, and we were able to really organize East Los Angeles to produce for Bobby Kennedy to the extent where there were 11 precincts that had 100% voter turnout on the primary election day. 7 out of those 11, everybody who voted in the election voted for Bobby Kennedy in the primary. It was a tremendous campaign. It's the best mm-hmm. I've ever seen in terms of an intense, very well-organized thing, before or since. And then, we all went to the Ambassador Hotel, and everybody witnessed his assassination. It was a big shock for people when that happened.
How do you think that the assassination of Bobby Kennedy did it demoralize the whole movement itself at that time?
Well, I think there was, there were a number of assassinations, that had happened, in relatively small number of years. Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, John Kennedy, those assassinations. And there are other lesser kinds of assassinations that were going on in the struggles mm-hmm. in the black community and the Chicano community with more militant groups like Black Panthers and so on. And, that was a period where there was real brutal attack on people's movements all over, you know. And it was almost regardless of whether they were nonviolent or advocated by whatever means necessary or whatever. So I think had that been an isolated assassination, it might have been more demoralizing than it was, but it was in the context of a lot of other things. So I think it mm-hmm. hurt, and it was a shock. But I don't think it deterred anybody from doing what they needed to do or what they felt they needed to do to try to make change in their lives or for other people. And I think his assassination, the impact, I think that he probably would have... he had won the Democratic primary in California, and I think he would have won the other primaries because the momentum that was built with that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democratic convention in Chicago would have been much different. And I think that he probably would have been the candidate. That he would have been in the center between McCarthy and Humphrey and would have probably been able to bring those factions together, and history would have been much different. And I think the people that wanted him out of the way saw that, what that represented. And that's why he was assassinated. I've never been convinced that Sirhan acted alone. It just didn't make sense.
No, neither have I.
And the irony is, when I was at Pasadena City College, he was in my speech class, and I knew him, but I wasn't friends with him.
Sirhan?
Yeah. And a good friend of his turned out later to be an undercover FBI agent that was investigating student activity. Mm-hmm. But his friend on campus was a guy named Bill DiValle, who the HUAC hearings put finger on Angela Davis later. You know, I think it was in 69 or 70, the last of the HUAC hearing, and exposed her as being a communist at UCLA or wherever she was.
Yeah.
So I've always thought that something else was going on with that.
And then from that period, after the working for the Kennedy campaign, that's when you went to Ohio?
After that, yeah, after the California primary. I think we took around 150 workers out all across the nation to reinforce mm-hmm. people that were already out on the boycott. And we went to Ohio, and first to Cincinnati, and then to Dayton, and Julio went to Cleveland, and another group went to Columbus, Ohio. And
what was the response of the Midwest, who probably didn't have much touch with mm-hmm. farm workers in the sense that mm-hmm. we see it here in California? Agribusiness. Versus the small farmer of the Midwest. How did they respond to your work in the urban settings for this boycott?
Well, in the urban settings in the Midwest, like everywhere else in the country, there was a lot of activity going on. In the African-American community, there's people that are involved in the peace movement. There are church groups that were concerned about, poverty and so on. So there was a tremendous amount of natural support. And then, of course, in the Midwest, it's more heavily unionized than generally most parts of the country. And there was a lot of identification with the struggle of farm workers and the shock that maybe a building tradesman or a UAW member would have of the conditions of farm workers. So there was really a very good movement on the boycott in the Midwest everywhere, whether it was in Pennsylvania or Ohio or Illinois or Michigan, wherever. What were
your living conditions like on the road?
Oh, well, we doubled up, in households, with the other families that were out. But
you were staying in residence homes of Cincinnati, say?
Actually, the church in Cincinnati, the Catholic Church had a house, or some nuns had a house that they never used, and so we mm-hmm. got that. We rented a house from a sympathetic landlord in Dayton, and we had the house and the office in the same place. And same thing in Columbus. And Julio, I don't remember what kind of setup he had. It was, I think he had an office separate from the living quarters. But we mm-hmm. had more than just the families. We had a lot of other workers with us.
Now, the grocers were receiving the grapes, and you were trying to stop the grapes from them selling the grapes. How was their initial response to you and organizing?
The chain stores resisted. And there was a link between them and the growers through the Farm Bureau and their marketing associations and so on. And the other side was very busy, too, and they're trying to get the food stores not to do it. And so not to give in. We had consumer boycotts going on, first with the grapes.
You had what going on?
Consumer boycotts, you know, okay. Where we're asking people not to buy grapes. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we began going after the chains to try to get them off. And in the Midwest, in Ohio, Kroger was a big chain, and it was unionized. And the family that owned Kroger was, you know, perceived to be, you know, moderate Democrats. They were active in the Democratic Party in the Cincinnati area, mm-hmm. and so on. So the idea was to try to put a lot of pressure on Kroger that they might give in and take grapes off. Well, sections of them did here and there, but it was a real problem. But the biggest supermarket chain of all in the Midwest was Jewel Foods, and it was heavily concentrated in Chicago. And so by, I guess, spring of 1969, we decided what we needed to do is bust the biggest thing, you know, in that area. So we got as many people as possible to get into Chicago and built a very intense network all over the city. And Jesse Jackson was involved with, at that time, Operation Breadbasket, and they took a certain part of South mm-hmm. Chicago, and they made sure they got the grapes off all the stores and made sure the managers would not order grapes. And the Black Keystone Nation took another section of South Chicago, and a union that had a concentrated membership in another part of the city took the neighborhood, and different groups would take different neighborhoods and go after Jewel Foods. And some of the more affluent areas where the volume of grapes was significant, Jewel would not take the grapes off, and we totally concentrated on them. And then by 1970, they finally gave in and said they weren't going to order grapes. Kroger gave in, other significant stores gave in, and that's when the...
These were all grapes or just the
California
growers?
Grapes.
California grapes.
Yeah, we were after all grapes. And then mm-hmm. first in, I guess it was by May of 1970, David Friedman Farms actually sat down and negotiated a contract and agreed to put the union label on his boxes. Mm-hmm. And so we began boycotting grapes without the union label and telling stores, you know, to get Friedman. And then, you know, as the other growers started signing up, you know, it was almost like a domino effect that lasted from mid-spring of 1970 through late summer, I guess, of 1970. And by, I guess it was by July, late July, we had the majority of growers had sat down and negotiated a contract, including Jamar.
Mm-hmm. I think I read somewhere that there was also, from the grower's side, a problem of switching labels on grapes and stuff?
Yeah, they were fooling around with that, but...
Can you describe how they were doing that?
They would get the boxes from one grower where the label was embedded on the wood side, and take it, and the paper labels that identified, you know, what grower they're from, they would, you know, move those around. Basically, the work that was done on catching them was done more in California, in, mm-hmm. in the fields, than it was, you know, with the food store.
Right.
So at that point, I wasn't real involved. That Marshall Gans and others were, Nick Jones and them were all working on that part of it. You know, I think they caught somebody switching labels in one of the warehouses where they were constructing the boxes and mm-hmm. busted them.
So how long were you in Ohio?
We were in Ohio,
Chicago,
I guess, for a little bit less than a year, and then in the Chicago area for a little bit more than a year.
Okay. And then where did you go from there?
Well, we had the victory celebration in Delano, and then Salinas started, the lettuce started. And I was already committed to go back to Texas because one of the things that we wanted to do is to, you know, restart the union and do a very concentrated organizing effort in the Rio Grande Valley. So that's where I went. Mm-hmm. And by the time... I think LSA went to Salinas, and most of the people had gone up there, and other people went to go administer the contracts around the state. But I went back to Texas, and...
When did you go back?
It was in the summer of 1970.
Okay.
And I was there, I guess, Tony Orendine was back, and the idea was to, you know, begin doing the basic organizing we needed to do to put together a union there, and I guess about after 3 or 4 weeks that I was there, the boycott started on lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was our perception that, you know, if we didn't win that, you know, we wouldn't have foundation of the union that could support the national organizing that we wanted to do. So I got involved immediately in setting up the boycott in Texas, and we took some workers from the Rio Grande Valley to help set it up. But we had committees there that we were able to get, you know, revive again, people that had helped on the Mellon boycott and so on. And it was very easy to get started again with the boycott network around Texas. And over the three to four years that we had it there, it was one of the more effective boycott operations. We had workers that came from the lettuce and so on that joined the boycott in Texas, as they did in other states, and a lot of support from people there. In fact, Artie Rodriguez at that time got involved with the boycott in San Antonio and then went on to work full-time with the union. And
so this was his first experience, Texas?
In Texas. Artie was from, he was a student at Our Lady of the Lake College, where we had a large group of students that were involved with the boycott. Then went on the boycott. He spent time with Richard Chavez in Detroit. Richard was up there, and I think that's where he met his wife.
So you were in Texas for another 3 years.
I was in Texas through to, I guess, about the winter of 74, 75. We had a big operation that that sustained itself very well. We were able to raise much more money than we spent. And we had about 30 people working full-time on the boycott, plus the organizing work in the Rio Grande Valley.
And then you come back to California?
I came back to California.
Or are you going back and forth, back and forth?
No, I wasn't going back and forth. I mean, we would for meetings and stuff, but I was in Texas basically from 73, we had the founding convention of the union in Fresno. We were all there for that, and you know, the week or two leading up to that, and after.
Can you describe the surroundings around the first constitution? And
well, I was on the Constitution Committee. Yeah, much of the framework of the Constitution was pretty much developed by the time I got there, and we were attempting to refine it and so on. And
what would you say are the key features of the Constitution? Those important pieces of it.
It was, to me, it was similar to most other union constitutions. I think on the surface, I think it was a very democratic document. I don't think it was really paid attention to afterwards, you know, but
Do you think that?
Well, initially there was, I think the changes, we were going to have a larger board than we ended up with, and I didn't really realize it at the time, but with a larger board it would have meant, you know, a lot more people involved and maybe different kinds of currents, and so I think the board was shrunk from 15 to 11 or something like that, and that, of course, limited the participation on the board of the union at that time. Or later, it was limiting. And I think there was an effort to really put the right people on the board. You know, and that also, the election to the board and so on was a big thing in the convention. And at that point, there were people that thought they were going to be able to be on the board, and when it was shrunk, they were left out of the slate, although it wasn't called that at the time. Mm-hmm. Others wanted to compete for positions, and I think probably more than anything, it was new. It's the first time people were running against each other, and there was bitterness, you know, beginnings of bitterness that began at that convention. Gustavo Gutierrez had wanted to be on the board, and for some reason he was isolated in the convention, and I think Marcos Munoz and some of the other people had wanted to be on the board, and for some reason, I don't know why.
Do you think there was any intentional things from a certain group within the union to do this?
I think there was. I wasn't really conscious of it at the time, but later on, you know, thinking back, you know, you could see that something was up at the time.
What do you think their view was?
I think they saw Marcos as a loose cannon, and Gus also. Gus was enamored at that time of Chinese kinds of things, and Marcos was a big militant, and but they were bringing, you know, different perspectives into the leadership of the union, as they had, you know, when it was informal, you know, before.
Right.
And they may or may not have been nutty, but, you know, they had part to play, you know, in the thing. And I think there was, that was the beginning of organized resistance to differing views. You know.
By the leadership.
By the leadership, yeah. And initially I went along with it. I didn't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. And then what did you do after you thought about it longer?
Well, you know, there was things that were going on, and, you know, I never was around Delano or La Paz very much.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned very early to stay away from the internal politics and organize, you know, and try to win the struggle. And I always made a point of staying away from those places. And I did then. I went back to Texas, and, you know, we continued with the boycott work and, you know, attempting to organize in the valley. At that point, Tony Orendine began to get very impatient, because it seemed like every time that we were on the verge of organizing, or being able to focus on Texas and organizing, something else would happen in California.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there were pressures from workers in Texas about, well, when are we going to do something here? Yeah. And he began, I think it was in, that was around 73, we had this, when the Teamsters attacked. That was a very vicious attack on the union, and I mean, clearly, the focus of everybody's work had to be on trying to win that. And
that was both in Texas and in California.
Yeah, everywhere, you know, across the country. And so that was another postponement for Tony. And I remember Caesar had wanted us to set up a network along the border to keep strikebreakers from being recruited by contractors to go to California, you know, with the Teamsters and the growers and so on. I was trying to get Tony to take an interest in that, and I got him to go with me to El Paso and meet with workers and other people in Juarez and so on, and he just was not into it. He just really refused to do any work. And it was impossible for us to do the boycott, to try to set up a network and the different things that we're doing. We didn't have the staff there, so I told Caesar just, you know, we just couldn't do it out of Texas, that Tony was resisting. And into 1970...
Was there ever a movement of some sort to create a separate union?
In Texas, it was in 74, 75. They, you know, the people in the UFW in Texas wanted to start an effort. And an incident happened at the border. The Socialist Workers Party types, both from Mexico and the United States, had started a campaign to try to reach immigrant workers at that time. And they had gone to the border to leaflet workers. And some of them got hooked up with UFW people and decided they were going to try to help recruit workers into the union. And I think that they're leafleting by Reynosa.
Say that, who was that?
The SWP types. And, you know, people from the United Farm Workers, workers or volunteers or whatever. They're leafleting at Reynosa. And the officials that were there on the border, you know, basically attacked them. And it became an incident, and it spread to, it led to a protest by workers who were active with the SWP in Mexico that came across as farm workers, and they started putting pressure on crew leaders and eventually had a strike, and then it snowballed into a legitimate strike. All kinds of workers got involved in it then. But it was a very quick thing, and it lasted just a few days. And then things kind of got back to normal, but it hit the national media. And Caesar was not really prepared to deal with that and was trying to go along with it. And I think he sent Gilbert Padilla and some others down to the Rio Grande Valley to try to figure out a way to get out of it, because it was too much, their perception that it was too much to take on all at once. Well, to Tony, that was a real affront, and to the people that were with Tony at that time, Rebecca Harrington and Jim Harrington and those, you know. Mm-hmm. And they were serious about winning the thing. You know, they, you know, it was time now to organize. They wanted to seize the time and try to build the union and try to get contracts, you know, with a strike and boycott. So what happened, they developed a parallel union within the union, so to speak, and started operating their own programs.